Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Tuesday morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, more companies around the world are being open to showing their gender numbers and policies. Plus, why are prescription drugs and the prices of them still so high?
But first, all of the rain and snow that we've seen across our state this year may have been good for our drought, but it doesn't bode well for the upcoming wildfire season. Yesterday, Governor Doug Ducey said at a press conference that this was the sixth wettest winter on record, but that came with a warning.
This is good news in the short term, but Arizona cannot afford to get complacent as we come to fire season.
He asked that all of us be responsible when we're enjoying the great outdoors this spring to avoid sparking a flame that could turn into a catastrophic wildfire. I spoke with State Fire Manager John Truitt earlier this morning. More about it.
With what are the normal winters, what that gives you is gives you a heavier fuel load in your grass and your fine fuels, which is the primary carrier of fire. So we have an abundant grass crop out there, and the grass is a lighter, flashier fuel, and it leads to more rapid rates of spread on our fires, and that's what we get when we get a wetter than normal winter.
Yeah. So is the weather outlook for this spring and summer looking like it's not going to continue to be wet? Like this is kind of inevitable that all of this new greenery will dry out?
Yes, the green up is going to take place and dry out. We're going to have a normal seasonality drying. And everything is lining up to become very cured by in the normal calendar year.
So this isn't the first like really wet winter we've had. I know it was out of the ordinary, but have we seen similar conditions in the past? And kind of what happened in the wildfire seasons that followed?
Yeah, this is lining up to be the same as the 2005 fire season, where you had the Cave Creek complex, which was a long-term fire that burned over 100,000 acres or so. So the similarities are there. The desert season will happen this year, according to a lot of the folks that have been fighting fire around here for a long time.
Mm-hmm. How do you fight these kinds of fires then when there's all of this brush and all of this dried out grass and such? Like, what are the unique challenges to that kind of fire?
Well, the unique challenge is that you can't use your normal fire barriers like, dirt roads, and sometimes the fires will even hang up on smaller, even game trails, but this year it won't happen. So you have to, adjust your strategies, look for better barriers, and then go from there. You're going to be, looking out for the firefighters with fine fuels. It's a faster moving fire. It can be dictated by micro type of wind changes. So it's a little bit more unpredictable when in the finer fuels.
Yeah. So is this going to present different challenges like in different places and different regions of the state? I'm wondering about like the high country where we've seen so much snowpack.
Yeah, the high country will be a little bit delayed fire season. But again, with the prolonged drought, the fuel conditions up there were pretty critical. So one wet winter, it'll delay the fire season, but it'll dry out just as well and become probably critical late in the year.
Right. So you're saying we have one wet winter here, but we haven't completely reversed our drought that's gone on for years and years.
No, and the long term effects of the drought are it's killed some of the vegetation out there. It's led to our pines and upper elevation evergreens are. They're more susceptible to pests, and we have a large area of weakened trees and then and actually dead, dying trees from the infestation of the bark beetles.
So what's being done at this point to prepare, since we know that this could be an extra deadly fire season?
We work with our cooperators. We work with our federal partners, our state and county emergency managers, our law enforcement, and we hold pre-fire season meetings and go over what the values at risk for everybody is. And then, we go over some strategy tactics, So basically, we do a pre-fire, a tabletop exercise, just to get to, strategizing when we're at a more calm type, tabletop exercise setting instead of being there with a big, smoke column in the air and chaos all about.
That's John Truitt, the state fire manager and officer for the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management, talking about the dangerous conditions leading into this year's wildfire season.
In late February, the Senate Finance Committee assembled the nation's top pharmaceutical company executives and grilled them on why prescription drugs remain so high. AbbVie Pharmaceuticals CEO pushed back, arguing without a high sticker price, progress stops. Here is that CEO, Richard Gonzalez.
If a market at the size of the United States were to collapse to the lower end of that pricing model, then I can just tell you AbbVie would not be able to invest the level of R&D that it invests today.
So what are the costs of doing business for American drug makers, and is true reform possible? With me to talk about that is Kenneth Caton, director of the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development. Kenneth, there are still concerns about the costs of buying prescription drugs. How much is the price affected by production and development costs?
I think if you look at the general cost of pharmaceuticals, it's a reflection in part on the enormous cost it is cost to develop these products. On the other hand, the price of an individual drug is not a reflection of the cost of developing that drug. I think that's a common misconception about pricing and R&D costs or research and development costs. The cost of developing an individual product is not reflected in the price of that drug. The price is a reflection more of the value that that drug brings, how it's going to be used, what the competition is, and perhaps most importantly, what the market will bear. In other words, what the insurers will reimburse for that drug. On the other hand, the industry frequently will say things like, they have to charge a lot for drugs because, as my group shows, it costs a lot of money to develop a new drug. In fact, we've done studies periodically over the past 40 years, and our most recent study shows that the cost of developing one new drug is about $2.6 billion. That's a capitalized cost, and it includes the cost of failures in the drug development process. So it's very expensive to develop a new drug. But if a drug doesn't represent value and an insurance company is not going to reimburse for it, it doesn't make any difference whether it costs $2.6 billion or $1 to make that drug. The company is going to have to charge based on what the market will bear.
So what do you, as someone who's involved in this, think when we hear critics say, well, it's outrageous that this particular medicine costs this amount of money? Are we really having to measure capitalism versus need? Is there a balancing act to be done here, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, that is the question of the day, right? That's the problem we have now. We have a pharmaceutical industry whose primary role is to develop new drugs and generate profits for its shareholders. And we have the needs of patients and insurance companies that have limited budgets about how much they can spend on new products. And at the end of the day, both groups want new drugs. Everybody wants new medicines, especially to treat illnesses where there are very few or inadequate treatments available. But the industry is going to charge as much as the market will bear. And the system that we have in the United States allows manufacturers to price the products at any level that they see fit. Other countries in the world have price controls, and they have other systems in place to ensure that the product prices are within a certain level. We've resisted that in the United States. I don't think it's politically feasible that we can have a system like that. But in the current environment, we've got a system where companies make drugs. They're allowed to price at a level that they feel is appropriate. And insurance companies can then decide whether they want to reimburse for those products or not. But no matter how you look at it, the cost to the patient is quite high, whether it's directly on the co-pays of the drugs or on the premiums that they're paying for their insurance policies. So unless there's a radical shift in the way we distribute healthcare in this country, we are sort of in an environment right now where we have to change the equation for assessing value in drugs, because that's the determinant. And there are mechanisms that are starting to be developed in this country that are doing just that. There are third-party groups that are making assessments about the value of particular medications and suggesting what they would consider to be reasonable prices for those drugs based on those value assessments. Now, understandably, the industry is not happy about this, but I think ultimately we're moving in that direction where we're going to need to make a determination about whether the value aligns with the price of those drugs.
How has the plethora of these inescapable, these ubiquitous ads for all sorts of different prescription medications, how has that changed the conversation, if at all?
Well, it's been a long debate in, about what the value is of direct-to-consumer advertising, the types of ads that you see on television. You know, my personal opinion on that is that it's something that the industry should not be involved in. This is an industry that's making life-saving drugs, and to me, to have an ad for a life-saving drug sandwiched between a car ad and a beer ad just doesn't make sense. It devalues the medication, and it actually, I think, makes the message of the industry a little more muddied. On the other hand, I think the industry's perspective on this is that, first of all, it does drive business, and it also, if nothing else, gets patients to go to their physicians and ask about these things, whether they get that medication or not. They end up going to the hospital or going to their doctor and saying, you know, it looks like there's a treatment and I'd like to talk about it. So I have not seen any substantial research that has demonstrated the value of these ads. But one has to assume that within the companies, they believe that this is providing a benefit from a financial standpoint to them. And for that reason, they're continuing to do it. As I said, if it were up to me, I'd say industry should get together and decide we're no longer going to do this.
So going forward, are you seeing a particular direction you think will take the stage, at least for a short period of time, in terms of getting costs under control or particular relations with the drug makers? What would change this particular direction, and what direction needs to be seen, I suppose? And is it a partisan issue?
Yeah. Well, under other circumstances, I would have said that the stars are aligned right now to actually accomplish something in this area. In a rare form of harmony between the two parties, that everybody agrees something needs to be done about this, I think there's a limit to how much the government can actually do in this space. I think the third-party approach is something that is the only way to get at this. So the question is, if the third party is playing the role of determining value in drugs, what role does the government play, or what can they play? And I think that they actually can play an important role in helping to set guidelines and standards for making these assessments. And that's something that I think everybody should be able to get behind.
Kenneth Caton is director of the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ. Thanks for listening. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein and Tanzina Vega with The Takeaway. Over the weekend, Facebook founder and chief executive issued a sort of mea culpa.
Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg is now coming out in favor of stronger government regulation.
It says the internet needs some new rules.
Four specific areas.
Harmful content.
Election integrity.
Privacy. Data portability.
Zuckerberg announced a new independent oversight agency that will review content moderation appeals.
So the company doesn't have to set those standards and is not accused of bias. Mark Zuckerberg thinks regulation is inevitable, so he's proposing what that regulation should look like.
In a Washington Post op-ed, Zuckerberg said government regulation needed to play a bigger role in reining in harmful content, stopping fake news, and protecting privacy on sites like Facebook. That sounds quite different from where Facebook was just 1 year ago.
This was a major breach of trust, and I'm really sorry that this happened. You know, we have a basic responsibility to protect people's data, and if we can't do that, then we don't deserve to have the opportunity to serve people.
Mark Zuckerberg there speaking to CNN last March after revelations that the data firm Cambridge Analytica had accessed information from 50 million Facebook users without their knowledge. Since then, Facebook has promised change, increased transparency, and a user-centric path forward. And yet, Facebook continues to be mired in controversy. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has accused the company of allowing racial discrimination through targeted housing ads on its platform, and civil rights groups have criticized Facebook for not doing enough to rein in white supremacist content. Today, we're looking at how to regulate the social media giant. Issy Lepowski is with me today to talk through the latest in the chaotic and scandal-ridden world of Facebook, and she's a senior writer for Wired. Issy, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's take it from the top. We heard a lot about Zuckerberg's urge for more regulation. Why now? I mean, is he trying to save image? Is this the optics? Is he under pressure? What's that? What is this all about?
I think he really has no other choice. Over the last year, Facebook has just been battered by the public, by politicians, by regulators in the United States, in Europe. It's happening around the world. It started with sort of the fake news debacle that emerged during the 2016 election. Then we heard about a Russian propagandist running amok on Facebook. Then the Cambridge Analytica news broke. Last year, they had a massive data breach. It's just been one thing after another for Facebook. And so regulators are increasingly looking at ways to rein the company in. They're looking at privacy regulation. California has passed privacy regulation. So they sort of have no choice but to come around to this idea, because really what they want is to play a role in shaping this regulation. They don't want it to happen without their input. And I don't think that regulators and politicians necessarily want it to happen without their input. Obviously, Facebook knows this industry better than anybody, but they need to strike a balance where these laws aren't too favorable to Facebook, that they actually protect consumers.
Do we have any sense of what regulation would actually look like on the platform itself?
Well, so Facebook has instituted its own set of rules, right? So they've gotten a lot stricter about what is and what isn't permitted on the platform. These are their sort of content moderation guidelines that have been evolving and are constantly being reassessed. So that's sort of their internal regulation. They've also, since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, cut off developers from a lot of the data that they previously had access to. But then what Mark Zuckerberg is talking about recently is all the regulation that really needs to be put in place by government. These are rules around election integrity. What sorts of digital ads can run before an election without having to say where the money's coming from, right? We have pretty robust laws governing how television ads are distributed and the sort of disclosures that they have to have. We don't have the same thing for digital advertising. One reason we don't have that is because for a long time, Facebook lobbied against it. They told the FEC, you know, this is impractical. We can't, you know, be publishing these disclosures for every ad. There's too many of them. Well, guess what? Facebook has already started doing those disclosures on their own. They're just asking now that all platforms have to level the playing field.
Mark Zuckerberg has often talked about Facebook's mission, and I want to play a clip from 2017 where he's talking to my former colleague Lori Siegel at CNN about how he describes what Facebook is meant to do. This was from 2017. Let's take a listen.
So our new mission is to bring the world closer together. And for the last decade, our mission has been to make the world more open and connected. And we've been really focused on these ideas, giving everyone a voice and helping to connect people, especially with their friends and family. And I think those are really good things, and we're going to keep doing them. All right? We're definitely not done with that mission yet. But now, I just feel like we have a responsibility to do more in the world. Right? I mean, when you look at the world today, you know, giving people a voice and helping people connect are good. And they've made the world better in a lot of ways, but our society is still very divided.
So, Issy, Facebook has brought together more than 2 billion users to its platform internationally. But this sort of pie-in-the-sky idea to combat divisiveness and bring people together, I don't know. I mean, it feels like Facebook is doing the opposite.
It does feel that way. It feels like Facebook has driven us all into these echo chambers where we're just talking to like-minded people. And in some countries, we've seen that can be really dangerous. You have Facebook fomenting violence in Myanmar and Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka even temporarily shut Facebook down because they didn't feel that they had a handle on controlling all of this violent rhetoric. Mark Zuckerberg's vision for a more open, inclusive, connected world has not necessarily panned out the way he wanted, which is why he's now talking about building a new vision for Facebook, which is focused on privacy. It's focused on messaging. It's focused on if Facebook newsfeed is the digital town square, then he wants to build the digital living room where you have the private conversations with your friends and family. Now, the question is whether people are really going to trust a company like Facebook that has such a spotty history when it comes to privacy with these private conversations going forward.
Also screenshots, but we'll get to that in a minute. Facebook, you mentioned violence, and Facebook did struggle to manage, if you will, or contain the video of the man who shot and killed dozens of worshippers in two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand recently. What are they doing to try and prevent that type of content from spreading online?
This is a really tricky problem for Facebook and for other tech companies. We saw YouTube struggle with this too. Facebook takes one approach, which is hashing videos that it knows are against its policies. Hashing is essentially giving that video or photo a digital fingerprint so that every time you try to upload it, you're automatically blocked. And we know that Facebook did block over 1 million uploads of this video within, I believe, the first 24 hours. But the problem is people are pretty smart and they know how to get around these sorts of parameters. So you might take a video of the video, right? You take it on your phone and it's recorded on, it's playing on your laptop. That looks different to Facebook's algorithm. So what they have to do is get a lot better at spotting those sorts of variations of videos. They've also floated some new ideas. For instance, Sheryl Sandberg said that considering what we know about some of these people who have caused the most problems on live videos, maybe there's a way that we can see if they have broken our rules in the past, we prevent them from going live in the future. So that might prevent people who are constantly problematic on Facebook from distributing even more problematic content in real time via live stream. Obviously, there are ways that that can go wrong too, because sometimes people use Facebook's policies as sort of a way to punish other users. Even if they haven't broken the rules, they'll, you know, gang up on somebody and say that they have. So Facebook still needs to figure that out, but these are some of the ideas they're considering.
Speaking with Issy Lepowski, senior writer for Wired, and we're talking about whether the new changes to Facebook or can increase transparency and accountability. So we talked about violence on the platform, but there's also a question of what Facebook tags as offensive. There's been a big debate around what's considered white nationalism, white supremacy, Islamic terrorism, Islamophobia. Who makes these calls, Issy? And who decides at Facebook whether something is or isn't racially offensive or racist?
Right. So Facebook has a big team that analyzes its content moderation policies. And this is an enormous living document that's constantly evolving. This team is led by a woman named Monica Bickert. And they will assess, you know, Facebook's rules on a range of issues, from, you know, images of graphic violence to hate speech, as you were talking about. But the problem is a lot of times these policies follow something that's already gone wrong. So we saw Facebook evolve substantially with regard to how it moderates, for instance, ISIS-related content. And this was largely driven by the fact that this was a national security priority under the Obama administration. They gathered with a lot of Silicon Valley leaders and said, we need your help. You are becoming recruiting platforms. We need you to crack down on this. And so the companies banded together and they agreed to start sharing some information about the content they were seeing. We haven't seen that same national security priority with regard to white supremacy. And so I think that the policies of these companies sort of follows that. Now, Facebook has just recently announced that they will no longer allow white nationalist content on Facebook. For a while, they were reluctant to do that because they categorized white nationalism as an identity, right? No different from other identities that people are rightly proud of on Facebook and build communities around on Facebook. But Facebook says, you know, we've done our learning and we have realized that you cannot separate white nationalism from white supremacy. Maybe an obvious idea for some of us, but for Facebook, when they're making so many decisions that they feel have to apply to billions of people around the world coming from a range of contexts and cultures, it wasn't something that they were ready to jump on until now.
Also, you know, Facebook, we often say we are the product, right? Because we, the users, don't pay for it. And Facebook has always said it's free and it always will be. But there are advertisers who are paying to have space on Facebook. How do they feel, do we know, about the potential for regulation on the site? I mean, is it better for like a big advertiser to say, you know what, I'd much prefer to have my ad there without a white nationalist, white supremacist content next to it?
Sure, I think that's certainly an upside, but there are downsides. So for instance, Facebook has put in some parameters around election advertising. So now you can go in and see what everybody has spent on election ads, who they've tried to target, where they've tried to target them, every single ad that they have posted, and the content. And so that has really changed things for political advertisers, because they say, well, now the competition can see what I'm doing. And not only that, but they have to make sure they're putting messaging out there, which, by the way, they should have been doing but anyway, but that they're okay with everybody seeing, right? In the 2016 election, one really controversial idea was the fact that you could target an ad to a small slice of people and the rest of the electorate would never see it. And so maybe that ad was a little bit teetering on the edge of what's appropriate. Now it's all out in the open. So that's one way that advertisers have been a little bit wary of what Facebook's doing.
Reminds you of being in the living room and all watching the same ad together. Issy Lepowski is a senior writer at Wired. Issy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's Tanzina Vega with The Takeaway. Bloomberg released its 2019 Gender Equality Index on the heels of the global Me Too movement and increased awareness of women's equality. And it showed the index, which measures companies who voluntarily disclose how they promote gender equality across their policies and statistics, doubled this year. And according to Kirsten Barnett, who manages the index, it shows that across the world, more organizations are prioritizing transparency and equality. She says, starting at the top, they've seen a 40% increase in women in executive positions in just the last 2 years, as well as the policies and benefits companies are offering.
So I think we're really seeing companies recognize that there's no such thing as a traditional family structure anymore, and that they have to offer policies and benefits that are reflective of that. So things like adoption, paternity leave or secondary leave, the amount of leave offered. We're also seeing some areas like the supply chain and some external impact areas that companies are doing more around. And I think that's exciting because when you look at companies of this scale, I mean, the companies in our index employ a total of 15 million people around the world. You know, that's great that what they're doing for those 15 million. But when you then think about how much money and how much business they're directing through their supply chain and how they can influence that by also incorporating a gender and diversity lens, I mean, that's when you really get to see this accelerated change.
They're also seeing companies do more to recruit women for those high-level positions and women who have taken a break in their careers and are looking to return to the workforce.
We've seen some really creative programs. Some companies are doing things where it's a year-long internship or kind of apprenticeship to help them build their skills back up. And then at the end, you know, those that have done well find full-time positions. Others, you know, reach out to the women that have left their own workforce from that company to then just let them know that they're here and this program exists and that they'd love to have them back. And so I'm excited to see that it's not just entry-level recruiting. We're also helping fill that need there of women that took a time out from the workforce, because women are more likely to do that than men.
And what about the ongoing gender pay gap? Here's Barnett again.
60% of the firms conduct compensation reviews to identify gender-based variations in pay. So that would be the equal pay issue. And then 39% of them found disparities and took action to fix it in that same year. What was really interesting this year is that if you looked at last year, you had roughly about the same doing the compensation reviews, 60%, but not a single company in the U.S. made the results public. And only a handful around the world did. This year, a third of the companies, a third of the 230, made their results public.
So to find out what this growth looks like in real life, we turn to Valley CEO Cheryl Palmer. She's at the top of local home building company Taylor Morrison. She came into our studios recently to talk more about being a woman in charge in this traditionally male-dominated industry.
Well, when I first started at Del Webb, I was a sales manager. And, you know, 30 years ago, I'll be honest, the view of how different departments, not even necessarily around gender, but how different departments came together and communicated, sales and construction, there was just like this 10-foot wall. People didn't talk. Mm. Well, that's just not my way. And as a individual, as a manager, a leader, and so I just start breaking down those walls. Mm. And, well, I've got to learn what construction does so I can be good at my job. And one by one, it just became the way I operated. And then in the businesses I was part of, it became the way we operated. And so it was great because I think, or actually strongly believe, that the men really appreciated. I would go walk a house before a customer or before a homeowner different. one's not better, one's not worse. Our lens is just different. And the more diversity you have in that lens, it doesn't matter if it's walking a home before you deliver to a customer or dealing with business issues around a leadership table, that diversity of thought is what makes us better. Mm-hmm. And I think when people, you know, recognize or are part of that, they see that. It's not threatening. It's different, but different's not bad.
Not threatening, but different. Mm-hmm. Was there a time when you had to battle that, when you had to sort of say, you know, it doesn't matter that I'm a woman, or you got a comment that made you bristle?
You know, of course. There would always be situations. And then I think my takeaway would be, well, you know, that's too bad that they think that way. Hmm. But I would never let those comments change my disposition, never let them change the goal at hand, my beliefs on what we needed to do from a business standpoint. And today, it's wonderful because I look at our workforce today, which is really half women, half male, and it is not even an agenda. It's not something we have to talk about because it is really so embedded in our culture that we're always looking for the talent, and that diversity in the way people approach opportunities and challenges, that it's just a really healthy environment.
Yeah, so I understand you've made quite some progress at the company in terms of gender equality and from the workforce, like you mentioned, but all the way up to the board.
Mm-hmm. And I wish I could tell you, maybe I wish I could tell you that we had all these wonderful infinity programs that had initiatives in the schools to get, you know, women, and we just haven't. Mm. But what we have had in the organization is best talent always wins. Mm. I'd say there's two rules. A tie between skills and ability, you know, between an internal and external candidate would always lean internal if it was a tie. Mm-hmm. And best talent always wins. That's the rules of how we recruit in the organization. And when there is no bias and you're gender blind, color blind, and you're really looking for talent, it changes the landscape. It changes the candidates that you're able to see to really understand great talent, mm-hmm. and to grow a company. And I think the number that's even more wonderful is about 36-37% of our management and leadership are female. And that's just unheard of in our industry. But there's nothing, there was no planning around that.
So it sounds like you didn't go about any of this sort of saying, I'm going to blaze the trail, I'm going to be the first one, I'm going to knock down all these barriers. It was just a very matter of fact, this is what the job needs kind of approach for you.
I think that's right. But having said that, I think what I'd add is once you're managing, leading a diversified workforce, you do need to have a level of consciousness of how different that is.
Yeah.
And to make sure that the programs that you have in place and that the thoughts around the table are genuinely desired, and that diversity of thought is valued in the organization and equal pay is valued in the organization.
So this seems like this is the way a lot of the business world is going, although I know you said it's not quite this far in the home building world. The Bloomberg Gender Equality Index, which you are on that list, you know, just got a lot bigger. They doubled since last year. More companies seem to be understanding that gender equality is an important thing. What kind of difference do you think having a diverse workforce and management and a diverse makeup of your board has made for the business?
Oh, I think it's huge. And I think we haven't even begun to appreciate the impact it's going to have looking forward. If I think about our customer base, I mean, why wouldn't, as any business, forget home building, but here, this is such an important financial decision that consumers make. I mean, arguably the largest financial purchase they make. And, you know, there's a lot of research that says the female's the decision voice. There's other research that says they're the veto voice. But either one, they're important. And if our management, our leadership, our workforce doesn't mirror the customer, then how can we possibly begin to understand their needs and wants? I mean, you can do research, but you got to live a day in it.
Yeah. So where do you see this going? Do you think that there obviously needs to be work done, but do you think that the tide is turning and that businesses, especially businesses in male-dominated industries like yours, are changing?
You know, the stats would suggest not. But I think, you know, it's how meaningful the steps of progress are. I think it's the speed of the journey. I think there's a lot of focus on it, and there's focus on it in the investor community. So from public companies, I hope they're doing it because it's the right thing. When I look at kind of the folks being educated and what's coming out of college, you know, the people that are coming out of college and the depth of undergraduate and graduate degrees and how that doesn't mirror the professional organization, it tells me we have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. But the pipeline's changing. So I think in time, absolutely. So the talent will be there. The bias has to go away. And then I think you have a perfect match. It has to come from within the heart of the organization. It's not something the street in public companies, because then you can put the numbers on the board, but you won't be able to execute. And I think what will help the heart of the organization is seeing the benefit of what that diversity in thinking. And I'd also say we need it in gender, but we also need it well beyond gender.
Yeah.
This is really only one important piece.
Yeah. Cheryl Palmer, CEO of Taylor Morrison. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Valley is internationally regarded for its selection of unique and interesting hotels and resorts, but it's unlikely any prior developments or projects had a lot in common with the hotel concept being brought here by Meow Wolf, the Santa Fe-based group that offers what could be described as a surreal and immersive arts experience. The hotel will be new for Meow Wolf, and it's scheduled to open in 2024 in Phoenix's Roosevelt Row Arts District. I recently spoke with Vince Cadlebeck, CEO and co-founder of Meow Wolf. I started by asking him for sort of a short mission statement about Meow Wolf.
That's like the hardest question, okay. By the way. The best thing is, you know, it's hard to describe. You just have to go see it. But if I was to really try, I would say Meow Wolf is an arts production company that produces immersive storytelling experiences. And basically, we provide large amounts of square footage of space that people go inside of. And it's filled with, you know, theatrical type of installations that are immersive and interactive that unfold in a sort of non-linear storytelling fashion.
You're expanding, so I'm suspecting that people are digging what you're doing. How did you pick the markets?
Yeah, you know, we think about where our brand is well known, where we see traction both on social media and also through the front door of the Santa Fe exhibit. And also, you know, a big part of it is partnership. I mean, we wouldn't go to a city unless we had met a developer or maybe an elected official or a business owner, you know, an investor, somebody that has made a connection with us that really wants to put energy into bringing us to their city. And so that's been the case in Denver and in Phoenix, actually, you know, everywhere that we're expanding to. That's been the case. The partnership has been kind of front and center.
Now, Phoenix is going to get your first hotel. I mean, this sounds, based on what Meow Wolf does generally, it sounds like the hotel is going to be an incredibly unique experience too. Can you give us an idea? I know it's a few years away, but what your vision for that is?
The hotel concept is a perfect fit for a Meow Wolf exhibition. It provides us a lot of different rooms that we can activate. It gives us an already pretty rich narrative setting. Like a hotel has a lot of story in it. And so, you know, what we want to do though, is we don't want to just have like the hotel where you stay next to the exhibition that you go and visit. You know, Disneyland does that. They do the attraction over here and then they do the hotel over there. What we want to do is we want to weave it all together. So the hotel is the attraction. Only a small percentage of people who visit the attraction will actually stay overnight in rooms. There'll only be a handful of rooms, maybe 200, 300 rooms. But even if you're just visiting the attraction, you'll feel like you're in a hotel from another planet.
Is it going to be like a surreal nature to it to some extent or no?
Oh, yeah. The whole thing is just like psychedelic and surreal and secret passageways everywhere. You might go into a hotel room and you might be exploring the hotel room of an alien guest. And then you go in the bathroom and realize the toilet is actually a hatch that opens up and it goes down into another world. You know, stuff like that. We're gonna really twist people's brains with this concept.
What do you want people who have been there to feel when they leave, or think about what they leave, or talk about when they leave?
Yeah, I want people to feel transformation, like they're a different person coming out of a Meowulf experience than they were going in. I want to blow their mind, and I want them to feel a sense of magic and awe and joy in their experience. Hopefully, people can leave the exhibit realizing that the world has the ability to be a much cooler place. I want to provide a context where it's like, you know, the world can be more creative, it can be more colorful, it can have different social contracts, it can be more explorable, more dynamic, weirder. Those are all the types of things that we want people to kind of feel when they come out.
And you still sound like you're incredibly jacked about doing this.
Oh yeah, for sure. We're changing people's lives. I mean, we're changing the landscape of art and creativity. We're actually bringing creativity to the lives of people who have been shut out from the creative process. The art world, to be frank, has alienated 90% of the general population around the world. And the art world is really just for a handful of, you know, the 10% of people. I don't think they intended to do that. I think the economics of the art world did that for them. But what resulted is 90% of the world is disconnected from creative experiences. And it's kind of unreal. And so what we're doing is we're providing an accessible way for people to have fun, interesting, dynamic, creative experiences. And it's enlivening. It like opens people's minds and feeds them in a way that they didn't even realize they were hungry for.
So Vince, we're talking about the hotel not opening until 2024. Is that because there's just so much unique stuff to plan based on how Meowulf does stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big project. 2024 is maybe the date, could be earlier, not sure. But, you know, it's a big project. It's going to be one of the larger buildings in Phoenix, definitely one of the larger buildings in Roosevelt Row area. It's very unique and dynamic. And we're trying to create something that is literally like world class. Like there's nothing else like it in the world. That's the way that we're looking at it. So, you know, it's going to take some time. We're going to be getting a lot of local Phoenix artists, and that also takes time. And so we want to go through an RFP process, and we want to review, you know, people's concepts and get to know the city. So there's a lot there that's going to get put into this project. And so, you know, a 4 or 5 year project cycle like that is, I think, to be expected.
And that is Vince Cadlebeck, CEO and co-founder of Meowulf, which is bringing its first hotel to Phoenix.
And now we continue with season 2 of KJZZ's Untold Arizona series, celebrating the state with stories outside of the usual news. In an old mining town west of Tucson, an arts community is thriving. An historic school has been preserved into affordable artist housing, and creatives are flocking to the desert to live there. In this next story of Untold Arizona, KJZZ's Casey Kuhn introduces us to the characters keeping the building alive.
This upright piano is extremely out of tune. It's being played by a musician slash photographer slash video editor in the library of a century-old school building. Bobby Narcho lives here.
It's got a lot of history here, and it's gorgeous. You know, it's grand. It's one of these grand places, and it's very spooky, too.
He's describing the Curly School in Ajo. It's where he processes his photos, eats his meals, and writes his music. Narcho grew up on the Tohono O'odham Nation just east of here. His tribe traditionally uses music to celebrate the bounties of nature, like the crops growing or the desert rain.
It is your native land, and there's a lot of culture there.
Ajo, where Narcho lives now, is like a model town at the intersection of the reservation and Mexican border. Lorraine Marquez Eiler is also Tohono O'odham.
It's history for the people. It's a lot of memories. You know, we all went to school here. I went to school here. This is where we grew up.
Ajo is a town built and ultimately abandoned by the copper mining industry. Half the population left when the mine closed, and many old homes were destroyed. On a tour of the school's wooden-floored, vaulted auditorium, Marquez Isler reflects on her memories from high school at Curley.
There's one that will forever stick in my mind.
She was about to be a freshman in high school in this auditorium during an annual hazing incident meant to mimic a slave auction.
It went above and beyond. We were dressed in sacks, and we were marched in there, and we were sold off to a student.
How did that make you feel?
Terrible. No, it was totally embarrassing.
She grew up in the segregated Indian village built closest to the mine. That was where the Native American mine workers lived. Then there was the Mexican town and the Anglo-American town. Ajo was master designed by the developer of the giant copper mine that still looms over the town.
The plaza and the school were a place where everybody was welcome.
Tracy Taft is a former executive director of the International Sonoran Desert Alliance, or ISDA. It's a local group trying to preserve history. The ISDA took up a vision from the locals, turned the then abandoned school into affordable housing apartments for artists.
Could we use bringing artists to Ajo as a way to kind of jumpstart a new economy here?
Only about 3,000 people were left after the mine closed. Marquez Isler says they heard the same thing from everyone, save the historic buildings.
It was just an empty space. Now it's thriving. There's all kinds of activities. It's just alive.
The school features two wings, a bell tower, and intricate carvings around the entrance, which sits about 10 feet above the street. Now the school is populated by artists like Army veteran and nature photographer Arnold Alexander.
As soon as I saw a flower through the lens, I was hooked that this is it. For some reason, this is it. You know, never look back.
Alexander lives in the old elementary school with his dog, Marley. He found the Curley School on Craigslist 9 years ago.
I'm pretty lucky to have this place because, you know, I was looking. I didn't know really what I was looking for. I knew I had to leave where I was.
Alexander's neighbor is painter Charlie Andrianov. He was born in a post-Nazi Germany refugee camp before his family moved to New York. His abstract paintings look as if you took a high-powered microscope to a spot of lichen.
Nothing in nature is simply one color. A rock, even granite, you'll find like a multiplicity of colors.
Andrianov says these stones can even seem sentient. He's able to connect with Ajo in this spiritual way.
You know, I feel more at home here because most of the people in this town are people who have suffered a lot of history, suffered from the results of being exploited, suffered from their land being exploited. So as an immigrant myself, I identify very much with their situation today.
The Curley School for Artists is home for people looking for inspiration in the desert. And it's a way of celebrating Ajo's colorful and complicated past.
There's still a lot of stories that need to be told, but that'll come.
Marquez Isler says the success of the Curley School project is one step toward preserving those memories. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Ajo.
For a look at more Ajo artists and their work, go to untold.kjzz.org.
Good Tuesday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Still to come this hour, how did the foreclosure crisis affect how Valley residents voted? Plus, we'll hear from a longtime Valley food critic. He'll tell us about a James Beard nominee.
But first, yesterday, Senator Martha McSally met with NGOs, elected officials, and border enforcement representatives for a roundtable on the immigrant crisis at the border. Here's how she described the gathering.
We've had 18,500 individuals released into the community in Arizona over just the last couple of months, and the numbers continue to go up. So we had a good discussion about some of the challenges with coordination and communication, challenges with just the overwhelming numbers that they're having. There's continuing a discussion up there without me because I got to head to the airport here and fly to D.C., but the conversation will to be continued.
But for our next guest, Senator McSally's words to be continued are not enough. Jennifer Buck with All Hands AZ, a non-governmental organization that works to support migrant needs, says she and other invitees to yesterday's meeting were left disappointed. She's here to explain why. Jennifer, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about what was the issue here yesterday.
Well, I think we all came in really optimistic. We are looking for governmental support. We're looking for somebody to step up and own this problem. And we came in very optimistic. And unfortunately, I think a lot of us were left very disappointed.
What were you hoping to get out of this?
Well, we were hoping that the government would step up and own this problem and acknowledge that as a state, we need to be able to control the flow. We need to be able to support the NGOs and faith-based communities that are helping this and actually be a part of the solution instead of attempting to put it back on the NGOs.
And tell us where this problem stands right now. Like how big has this gotten? How overwhelmed are you and other organizations like yours?
Well, I want to make it really clear that we are handling this issue. We are, as you know, a faith-based community and with all of these nonprofit organizations, we are absolutely handling this. No one is going hungry. We are making sure that these people are within the city for 24 to 48 hours max. They're seen by doctors, they're clothed, they're taken care of, and they are sent on their way. But what's happening right now is that everybody's pointing the finger at the other political figures, and no one wants to own what's going on, and we're looking for support. We're looking for someone to come in and help us make this better.
Well, responsibility, support, these are important words. So does it become one of those things that as you're trying to handle it, though, becomes more daunting, it becomes more challenging? I guess if we could get more specific, what are the expectations for other than sort of saying, hey, we'll help you, we'll support you? Are there certain direct actions you'd like to see the government take, whether it's leadership from Senator McSally, Senator Sinema, someone like that?
Yeah, you know, we have been working in concert with the Democratic leaders. They have stepped up. So McSally coming to the table yesterday was a bit late, I'm going to be honest. And so we have been asking for a few things. We need some type of permanent shelter. We need something that looks like what they did back when Hurricane Katrina occurred. We opened up the Coliseum and we supported those people when they were in need. We also need some type of financial support. Right now, this is being carried on the backs of nonprofits, on the backs of the community. We've got 200 to 300 people being dropped a day in our community. And what's happening is that these groups are shielding the community from actually having to see these people sitting on the corner of 24th and Buckeye. Mm. So not only do we need a shelter, not only do we need some kind of financial support, we need some security, frankly. We need somebody to step up and say that they're willing to protect the process that we are trying to facilitate for the city.
So if you do take Senator McSally at her word there that this is a continuing process, it's a good thing, though, you're getting attention from somebody at that level, right?
Well, yes. I mean, we have actually had conversations with people at her level. We have had the conversations where we have heard that it's not a federal issue. We've been told that this is not something that our federal government is going to take on. And so they point to the local and state. And local and state is trying. They are genuinely talking to us behind the scenes, attempting to help us out. But the problem is our numbers are increasing. We have a very capable NGO community. We have an unbelievably supportive community that wants to give. I mean, it's unbelievable to see how this community has come forth to support us. That we have down. But what we need is for some of the political, you know, players to step up and say that they are willing to support us in the, you know, the areas of shelter and some of the funding. That's really what we need.
Well, I often wonder, too, whether how much of this is about, certainly you need practical financial support, but also even just the idea of spirit, feeling like you're kind of in this together as opposed to, no, you can take care of it. It almost seems like that's what you're expressing.
Yeah, you know, the truth is we all are loving what we're doing. This is a passion project, and we love that we are taking care of people from the moment they're out of custody to being reunited with families. We love that, and it brings many of us to tears saying goodbye to these people. But what we want is for our leaders to reflect the same values that we have, and that's not being seen. We want our organizations to be supported, but mostly we want our politicians to reflect what we believe in, and we're not seeing that in their actions.
One last question for you, Jennifer, before we let you go, and briefly, if you can. What would you say to people who don't know enough about who these people are who are coming and the migrants that are coming in and the numbers and what it is that they're going through? What do you want them to know about that?
These people are petrified. They are absolutely terrified and running for their lives, and they are coming here because their lives are in danger. They are seeking asylum. They are looking for somebody to protect them. And I'm going to tell you that their belief in America is much greater than my neighbors, if I'm completely honest. They believe in us. They want to be a part of this. They are running to make sure that their children are safe. And we need to be able to be here to support them adequately. And we just need our government to step up and help us in that process.
All right. Jennifer Buck with All Hands AZ. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And now there's more than a humanitarian crisis to consider. There's also an economic one, as President Trump continues to threaten to close the entire U.S.-Mexico border. Each day, people cross the U.S.-Mexico border to work and do business in the city of San Luis, Arizona. While President Trump threatens to close the border, the news is already having an impact on that city. Jerry Sanchez is the mayor of San Luis and joins us this morning. Good morning, Mayor Sanchez.
Good morning.
So we understand that news of the border closure has your phone ringing off the hook. Who is calling? What are their concerns?
It has not stopped for the past 2 days. It's been hectic. I'm getting phone calls from parents. I'm getting calls from business owners from across the border and local merchants because they don't know what's going to happen. I just a little bit of history. San Luis is a population of 37,000 individuals. 8 million people cross that border yearly of our ports. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, anytime you mention delays or closing the border, 70%. Of the sales tax generated to run my city is generated for people that cross the border daily. And so anytime you mention about closing the border, it affects us directly, not only Yuma County, San Luis, but the state as a whole. And it's worrisome. I have parents petrified. They don't know what to do because if you close the border, you will divide families. And we're talking about legal immigration. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, and there's a lot of people who are upset. They're upset because of what's going on. They're upset because of our local government and federal government. And it's a crisis. It really is. When you talk about closing the border, the ports of entry, it really impacts my community directly.
Mayor Sanchez, I want to ask you also about the migrant crisis as well, about all of these people coming across the border or seeking asylum. We just heard about the hundreds who are being dropped off every day here in Phoenix. What does that look like in San Luis?
What's happening is they're not crossing through our ports. They're crossing over probably a mile and a half away from the port where there is no fencing. And the thing is, we're talking about 800 crossing daily or between 200, and it's a continuous number, and the numbers keep continue going up. The problem is when the federal government decides to send 750 CBP officers to Texas, you basically take away from our ports, creating a very unsafe environment for our ports. Ports are very important for national security, but they're also catalysts for economic development. And the thing is, it's affected in the other ways. So, for example, right now, there's delays of 2 or 3 hours in a vehicle of traffic. If you decide to cut down on CBP officers and cut lanes, that wait that used to take 2 or 3 hours is taking 5 to 6 hours to cross. And that will affect us directly. In a way, they're already closing our ports. The delays, pedestrian crossing over, it's taking hours to cross over. So it's already having a deep impact.
Now, Mayor, we started by saying your phone's ringing off the hook. Who are you calling? Are you talking with members of Congress? Are you talking to senators, or at least trying to make sure they get this very, very emotional message that this isn't just some nameless, faceless figures out there?
I'm constantly talking to CBP. I'm constantly talking to our local mayors. Our local mayors regionally, the Yuma mayor, this mayor from Somerton, the mayor from Welton, we're all getting together and trying to figure this out because it not only affects us locally, it will affect the state, and it has a trickle effect. For example, the lettuce that we cultivate right now, more than half of the workers who work in agriculture come across the border every day. Thousands of people cross every day. If you decide to close the border, these ag workers are not going to be able to cultivate those crops. Guess what? Your lettuce that costs $1.29 now will cost over $5. So it will affect everyone. And it's crucial. Of course I'm talking. I tried talking to the port director yesterday. We normally have a direct line, basically, and we have good conversation. He's overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. The CBP, the port director, is overwhelmed. He couldn't answer me, but I'm pretty sure he'll call me today. And this is the kind of communication. We are getting a lot of support from our federal government. Right. But the thing is, it's a crisis. It really is.
All right. Jerry Sanchez is the mayor of the border city of San Luis in southern Arizona. Mayor Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The Valley was one of the hardest hit regions of the country during the midst of the Great Recession, and more specifically the foreclosure crisis in housing. Those circumstances found many homeowners underwater with their mortgages or forced them to move into rentals and give up property and, more metaphorically, the American dream. New research led by ASU Associate Professor Deirdre Pfeiffer indicates a change in their housing situations also affected how some people in Maricopa County voted in 2016. And Professor Pfeiffer is with me via Skype. Deirdre, how did you and your colleagues decide to look into the housing crisis impact on the 2016 election, considering the worst of that crisis had occurred several years earlier?
As housing scholars, we were wondering, you know, whether housing might have played a role in this election. And we were reading, you know, all the coverage showing different factors that may have played a role, from, you know, job losses in the Midwest to the Russian hacking, you know, allegations and so forth. What we saw was some colleagues of ours did work showing that there was potentially a link between counties that had large proportions of underwater homeowners and they're voting more Republican in the 2016 elections. And so we thought that was really interesting. And we're wondering whether we could demonstrate a stronger link between those two things. Steve, you mentioned how, you know, by 2016, we were pretty far out from the most acute part of the recession, you know, in that mid to late 2000s period. However, we've had a strong lingering effect of this recession in the form of underwater mortgages. And so a large proportion of homeowners, even in the early 2010s and going into the mid 2010s, still had not recovered to the mid 2000s home values. And so they still, in some respects, you know, were experiencing that loss of wealth from the recession. Yeah, to some extent, you know, we were out of the most acute stage of the recession in the form of concentrated foreclosures in neighborhoods and seeing, you know, all the effects of those unfurl. But in other ways, you know, there was still these lingering effects in terms of the loss of wealth among homeowners.
Many of us would think that that would have more of an effect, even with gerrymandering, it might have more of an effect on local races and legislative races or a mayoral race or a gubernatorial race. Did you look at that at all and see whether the impact seemed to be felt there as well, that people may have gone left or right, depending on their preference, based on how they were faced with the housing crisis?
Yeah, and so that was our idea, was to, you know, we saw some of our colleagues link this presidential race, you know, to the effects of the lingering effects of the recession. But our first kind of guess was that recessions and housing crises in particular would have more local effects first before national effects. And so indeed, that's what we were doing in our study, was trying to see whether we could isolate out this link between the experience of foreclosure in neighborhoods and then, you know, the kind of voting that was going on in the more statewide elections. You know, though we did study, in addition to the gubernatorial election in Arizona, we studied the state Senate races as well. So, you know, which kind of bridged the national to state, the national to state kind of geography, I guess you could say.
Could this be lumped into the same sort of concept that, as any adult, male or female, married, unmarried, when a person is feeling more secure in his or her job, when a person feels like I can afford all my bills, and that just affects attitude generally, and then maybe do people pay more attention potentially when things are not going as well because that instability? Yeah.
Yeah, I think for sure. And that's definitely an extension from our research. If you look into the political science research that's been done on voting, there's a strong history of looking at anti-incumbency in terms of election outcomes. And so many people have demonstrated that voters, they tend to, you know, reward or punish incumbents depending on what's happening in their lives, you know, how the economy is affecting their lives in a very personal way. So for sure. And I think, you know, one of the implications of our research is that, you know, we're showing that communities in Maricopa County that were harder hit by these foreclosures, where the recession was likely having a fairly deep effect on people's lives in those communities, that those voters may have decided to, you know, do whatever they could to punish people who were in power for the situation that they were experiencing. So yeah, I mean, in some ways, you know, our research found this anti-incumbent effect playing out in Arizona, and which is similar to this anti-incumbent effect that our colleagues have found in counties in the Midwest and Rust Belt with the Trump election. And what you're seeing there kind of in a big picture way is people who have been crushed down in our economy and, you know, who have yet to recover from, you know, all the effects of the recession are doing, you know, what is in their power through their voting to, you know, punish the people that, you know, they may think have contributed to them being in that situation.
We've already heard a lot of people running for president. Does it make sense that those candidates could or should talk more about affordable housing, about making sure we don't repeat the housing crisis? Do you think this is an issue that will rise to be talked about in a very serious way on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I mean, historically, I mean, if you look at kind of stump speeches and debates happening at the federal level, candidates for political office at the federal level typically don't bring up housing much. You'd be surprised, you know, it's surprising how infrequently it comes up. And this is surprising because, see, housing is an aspect of our lives that affects us so deeply in so many ways. So, you know, where you live, you know, affects the, you know, schools that your kids have access to, you know, what your commute is going to be like to jobs, whether you live in a safe community or not, how healthy, you know, the environment is in the neighborhood where you live. However, where we live also is deeply tied to our wealth, right? You know, so if you're a homeowner, you have the potential to gain wealth through where you live. So there's so many aspects of our housing that affect these diverse areas of our life that it's just shocking that, you know, politicians don't see those connections more and don't, you know, take a stand on housing issues more. So I think it's something certainly that should come up more. And politicians, you know, they overlook housing at their own peril. And this is something our research shows that, you know, again, we were able to demonstrate a link between the housing conditions, what's going on in the housing market in particular neighborhoods, and how people in those neighborhoods were voting.
Deirdre Pfeiffer is an associate professor at ASU School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning.
Better, stronger, faster. It's not the $6 million man. It's the official launch of American Airlines' newest plane. All right, ready? I'm going to say it. The Airbus A321neo NX. While the airline has been doing test flights, the Neo will now be fully integrated into American's fleet.
The inaugural passenger flight took off from Phoenix Sky Harbor this morning to fly to Orlando. The new jet has more seats and the ability to fly about 400 more miles than the previous generation of A321s. Brent Bowen is a professor of aeronautical science at Embry-Riddle University in Prescott.
It's a new aircraft with new technology operating on an optimal route.
The new Airbuses will replace the aging Boeing 757s that usually do the longer routes to Alaska or Hawaii. And this means there is a potential to open new routes out of Phoenix. Bowen says the new aircraft will allow airlines like American to run a more efficient business model.
I think American Airlines' strategy is to place the 321neos at locations like Phoenix that are basically, you know, have really long transcontinental flights. For example, Phoenix to Orlando, very popular destination. And carrying more passengers per flight means perhaps they could eliminate one flight per day, but still carry the same number of travelers and save money and efficiency in the process.
American has ordered more than 100 of these jets, which will be integrated into the fleet over the next several years. Other airlines like Delta and Hawaiian have also placed orders. And like every new plane design these days, there is extra when it comes to overhead bins, extra space.
Oh, all right. So now I can overstuff my carry-on?
Exactly. So if you've got like holiday gifts or golf clubs,
stick
perfect.
Stick them in, yes. There. All right. You're listening to the show. The Arizona culinary scene could be on the brink of something big. For years, our state's chefs and restaurateurs have been all but overlooked by the literal tastemakers who decide who wins the Oscars of the food world, the James Beard Awards. But this year is different. This year, Arizona had 10 semifinalists named, including many young chefs on their way up. And now one of those chefs is going on to the finals. Charlene Badman of Scottsdale's F&B is up for Best Chef Southwest. So does this mean Arizona food is finally getting its due? For more on that, I sat down with Howard Seftel, the now retired longtime restaurant critic for the Arizona Republic, who knows Arizona food probably better than anyone. And we started by talking about Arizona's lone finalist.
Charlene is one of these overnight successes who took 20 years to 20-year overnight success. A long background in New York. She worked for a long time with Chrisa Robertson at Rancho Pino. And then, I don't know, 6-7 years ago with Pavle Milic, opened up F&B. F&B, if, for people who don't know, is a food and beverage term. She's, how can I describe her philosophy? She's a perfectionist, and she's diligent, like any really, really good chef. She's not an empire builder. She's not an entrepreneur. She's not a marketer. She is a chef who is in the kitchen and actually doing the stuff. She's not a social butterfly. She doesn't run around and do talk shows or much in the way of demonstrations. It's extraordinarily admirable. The thing after almost 25 years reviewing restaurants is the thing I appreciated almost more than anything else is a chef who is in the kitchen doing chef work. That said, not only does she do chef work, she's incredibly talented. When I first reviewed the restaurant, I called her a vegetable whisperer.
That's right.
And the phrase seems to have become
it's
sort of
stuck
part
with her.
Of, part of the, when you introduce her, it's vegetable whisperer Charlene Badman. But she deserves it. What she does is extraordinarily good, and particularly with vegetables.
Yeah. So what does it mean for her and for the rest of the Valley food scene that she's been named as a finalist?
It's definitely puts her on the radar. And the way things work, Lauren, in food, particularly with fine dining, is that there are certain arbiters of taste. The elites who maybe in some specialty magazine or in the New York Times mention something, and eventually it percolates down into the mass media. So what's happening with Charlene and some of the others is that over the years now, this attention is trickling down almost into a mass audience.
Interesting. So there seems to be this perception that Arizona has not gotten its due or not reached the point where it should get its due as a food scene in America. Do you agree?
I do. And I don't want to say this as a promoter.
Yeah.
But Arizona, the first 15 years of the Beard Awards, absolutely dominated. They started, I think, in 91. But for the last 10 or 12 years, we've been literally off the radar.
Yeah.
Why? Frankly, because the people who make the decisions about what's good and what's not good didn't want to come here. SB 1070, the law that sort of permitted rounding up brown and black people for no reason, set us back a decade, literally a decade. There were state legislatures that passed laws forbidding employees on public duty to come to our state. So we had a reputation that was very, very hard to shake.
Hmm. So during that decade, the chefs and F&B people, food and beverage people in the state, though, continued? And did it hurt the scene, or did it allow them to sort of operate and get better under the radar?
Unfortunately, it paralleled the Great Recession.
Hmm.
So on one hand, we had sort of political economic circumstances hurting the state. And on the other hand, we had socioeconomic issues hurting the dining scene. Virtually nobody opened up anything fine dining for 7 or 8 years. All people wanted to eat was macaroni and cheese, meatloaf, salmon, and any sort of comfort food.
Yeah.
So the culinary scene did not develop in the way it might have when times were booming. So we really had a double whammy. I do want to say, though, over the last 2 or 3 years, we finally seem to be coming out of this trough.
Right. So what's changed? I mean, is this about an organized effort to switch this here?
Yes. Three things, I would say, have changed. One, the political situation has changed. We repealed SB 1070. Joe Arpaio is no longer our sheriff and in the national news. Secondly, the economy, although not for everybody, is better. And finally, there is now an organized effort speared mostly by an organization called Local First, which is trying to put the Valley and Arizona back on the national food map. And that's led by Kimber Lanning, who is in some ways almost single-handedly responsible for raising the profile of Arizona restaurants and Local First sponsors the Devour Phoenix event. And full disclosure, I'm a volunteer there. But what she's done is she's brought people to Arizona so the message can get out. In other words, if you're good, people who are influencers are going to know it and maybe talk about it.
Yeah. So this is proof this year when the James Beard semifinalist list comes out and 10 Arizona chefs are on it.
Absolutely. This is an indication that her plan, and she works in conjunction with the Scottsdale and Phoenix Convention Bureaus, you know, the tourist folks, but the plan, which is to get people to parachute into Arizona who might not otherwise be disposed to parachute into Arizona, to get them here and see the quality that we do have. And I think that's reflected this year in the 10 nominations, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it reflected next year.
Yeah, yeah. Was there a watershed moment?
I mean, recently?
Yeah.
No. It's word of mouth. We've had a number of local chefs who have been invited to cook at the James Beard House, which is in New York. And to cook there is a real honor. And we've had a number of Arizona chefs there. Mm-hmm. And the people who go to these meals, these are arbiters of taste, people who influence. So we've become known. And Kimber Lanning at Local First for the Devour event has brought in really, really high-profile people to judge the event. And I can tell you that when I was taking them around the Devour, they were saying to each other, I can't believe how much talent there is in Arizona. They had no clue.
They
now,
had no idea.
This is going to take a while. This is not a one-year or a two-year effort. But at least we're on the right track. And I'm just the messenger. I want the message to get out that there are some restaurants in this town, Lauren, that are as good as anything you will find in New York, San Francisco, or Paris. And that's where I spend about 6 months a year. But at the very, very top level, we can absolutely compete.
All right. We'll see what happens. Howard Seftel is a retired longtime Arizona Republic restaurant critic. Howard, thank you so much for coming in.
Quite welcome.
There's a battle in Congress over disaster relief funding. The Republican-backed bill was blocked by Democrats in the Senate yesterday. The sticking point, Puerto Rico. In 2017, the island was devastated by Hurricane Maria. The new bill would have reduced aid to the U.S. territory. Opponents say funding for the island has always been slow and more is still needed. And President Trump tweeted last night, writing the aid already sent to Puerto Rico has been, quote, wasted. Our next guest, Andrew Schrank, is a Brown University professor and a member of the CNE Growth Commission, a think tank on Puerto Rico. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So the fight right now in Congress is over this Republican disaster aid bill. They say there's only a limited pot of money and there needs to be wildfire funds for certain states and Midwestern flooding. Is all of this true? I mean, would that money be, in fact, used for that? And frankly, based on your opinion, would it make any sense to transfer those and reprioritize?
Well, I don't want to speak to the relative priorities. I think we need to fund disaster relief everywhere. We're a rich country, and I think we can afford it. And I think it's important to keep in mind something a lot of people on the mainland forget, which is that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, and they're no less entitled to this disaster relief than citizens of California, Arizona, the Midwest, et cetera. But I think it's also very important to keep in mind that this is potentially a positive-sum game. I mean, those farmers of the Midwest are in many cases selling their food in Puerto Rico, which is largely dependent upon food imports from the mainland. And so if Puerto Rico recovers, that generates great demand for Midwestern food.
Hmm. So what's the situation like in Puerto Rico right now? Like, has it improved to the point where they maybe don't need the same kind of relief funding?
No, I think that's completely fictitious. Puerto Rico is in terrible shape. Years of austerity had bled the island dry before the storm hit, and they've clearly taken a toll on the island's ability to mount a viable recovery. So aid from the mainland is absolutely essential.
So when you hear a tweet like President Trump's, and we know, or tweets in the series of tweets about how the money has been ill spent so far, beyond the fact that it is rhetoric and it upsets people, what kind of message does that send? And can Congress stand up to him? Do you expect them to?
Well, I mean, it's a divisive message, and I think it's a deliberately divisive message. It's filled with exaggerations and, in many cases, outright lies. I mean, he's talking about $91 billion, but people on the island haven't even seen a fraction of that. I mean, there hasn't been a fraction of that that's actually been allocated and spent to date. So I think he's just not to be trusted when he's talking about the situation in Puerto Rico, and I think what he's trying to do is rally his base through a xenophobic message, which, you know, ironically is particularly vexing. Because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens.
So is there anything to the challenge, though, of getting these funds out when they get to Puerto Rico? Like, is there government corruption? Are there things that are making it difficult for the people to see the impact of that kind of funding?
Well, you know, this is the rhetoric that often comes out of the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress. Puerto Rico is like a lot of jurisdictions on the mainland in regard to waste and corruption, you know, Chicago, Miami, probably New York. It's not a failed state or anything like that. I mean, you'd see occasional scandals. There can be a lack of transparency in certain contracts. But for the most part, it's like a, you know, big city jurisdiction on the mainland. And I haven't seen any evidence that the recovery efforts in Puerto Rico have been any more wasteful or less efficient than similar efforts in mainland jurisdictions, whether it be New Orleans after Katrina or Florida after Irma. You know, they're probably not batting 1,000, but if a jurisdiction has to bat 1,000 on this, we'd never give recovery aid at all.
Has Puerto Rico consistently been disrespected? Maybe not to this degree. Is there sort of a happier time we can go back to, something that when listeners hear about this, can they think, well, this is when Puerto Rico was the priority it should have been, as you say, as a U.S. territory equal to other U.S. citizens?
Well, I don't know if you would say it's ever been the priority that it should have been equal to U.S. citizens. There certainly was a happier time. I mean, in the aftermath of the Second World War, Puerto Rico was the fastest growing economy in the world and was looked upon as the model for what developing countries should aspire to in terms of governance, in terms of economic planning and priorities and things like that. And, you know, again, when President Trump says things like Puerto Rico's a disaster and it's always been a disaster, he's clearly, you know, blind, whether willfully or not, to that period. And, you know, almost implying that there's something cultural about Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans that impedes growth and development, when, you know, clearly that's not the case, because the culture and the language have always been the same, including in a period when it was the model for developing countries throughout the world.
So final quick question for you. If in fact this goes forward, or if aid is cut to Puerto Rico, where else can they turn? What can they do to get funding from anywhere else?
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems. Puerto Rico is not a sovereign nation. They can't go to the World Bank. They can't go to development banks that exist in other parts of the world. And as a result, they really don't have much of an option to go to Washington. But I think it's very important to keep in mind, when the Trump administration, you know, trumpets this message that there's been waste and fraud and things like that, that Washington itself, I think, is to blame for a lot of whatever mismanagement has occurred. You know, has occurred. FEMA doesn't exactly have the best track record in this regard, as witnessed by the resignation of the director. And Congress has imposed an enormous amount of red tape on Puerto Rico, both directly through the disaster funding mechanisms and indirectly through the imposition of a fiscal control board that imposes its own onerous rules. So we're effectively burying Puerto Rico in red tape and then complaining about the red tape. You know, I think Washington should look to Washington.
All right, we'll stop there. Andrew Schrank is a Brown University professor, member of the CNE Growth Commission. Professor, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein. And the takeaway is Tanzina Vega. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday morning. When Democrats won control of the House of Representatives last year, many lawmakers said they were eager to use their newfound majority power to hold the Trump administration accountable.
You know, they who have power in Washington have all power. And I think the American people have said they want checks and balances. The subpoenas that I want to issue would be much different than ones that what I've seen. I want to issue subpoenas that go to the very heart of our democracy and protecting that democracy.
That was Representative Elijah Cummings back in November, right after his party's midterm victory. Cummings is now the chair of the powerful House Committee on Oversight and Reform. And this Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee is set to vote on whether to subpoena Attorney General William Barr for a full release of the Mueller report. But just how effective is a congressional subpoena? And will the White House have to comply? Here to give us some history and context and maybe even some predictions is Margaret Taylor, a senior editor at Lawfare and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. So this is a lesson for me, and I'm sure for some of our listeners at least. Let's take it way back. Where does Congress's subpoena power even come from? What's the history of it?
So Congress's subpoena power is really part and parcel of its general investigative and oversight powers. And while those general powers aren't articulated specifically in the Constitution, the Supreme Court has over and over again affirmed that Congress's power to investigate and do oversight is broad, and it is rooted in the Constitution. And the subpoena power is designed to effectuate that constitutional prerogative for investigation.
And does the subpoena power differ between the Senate and the House or from committee to committee?
No, it doesn't. All of the subpoenas are valid that are issued from either the House or the Senate. In this particular case, it seems like there actually might be two different committees that may be authorizing subpoenas this week. The first is, as you had mentioned earlier, Elijah Cummings' House Oversight and Reform Committee, and then the second is the House Judiciary Committee.
When a committee subpoenas the executive branch, does the White House have to respond? And if so, do they have a time in which they have to respond? What's the process?
Generally speaking, yes, they do have to respond in some fashion. Now, there is one valid way for the executive branch to say, no, I'm not going to provide, the president really, to say, I'm not going to provide that information or provide that person to testify, is by asserting something called executive privilege. A valid assertion of executive privilege is a sort of a valid way to say, no, actually, in response to this subpoena, we're not going to be providing that information. Now, the question is, who decides what is a valid assertion of executive privilege?
I was going to say, what are the parameters of executive privilege?
In the past, most presidents in the post-Watergate era have invoked it in some fashion. It has been invoked to protect sensitive or national security-related information from public disclosure. It's been asserted to protect communications that the president has with his immediate advisors. It's been asserted to protect sensitive law enforcement-related information. So there's been a variety of situations where presidents have asserted executive privilege over the years.
This current moment that we're in is hyper-political, and if the subpoenas for the Mueller report actually happen, I'm expecting some sort of showdown. But have there been other high-profile showdowns between the legislative and executive branches about how this process works?
Definitely, and there have been such showdowns actually in all of the presidential administrations in the post-Watergate era. You know, President Obama asserted executive privilege with respect to some documents related to the Operation Fast and Furious, which was a kind of a ATF investigation and gun running operation that went wrong. And so Congress subpoenaed certain documents from the Department of Justice regarding that incident. And President Obama did end up asserting executive privilege with respect to some of the documents. Now, in that case, some documents were provided, some were held back, and there ended up being an actual court case for a judge to make a decision about those documents that the president tried to hold back. And in the end, most of those documents were provided to the Congress.
Do we expect a similar fight? I know it's early to say, but do you expect a similar fight over the Mueller report, for the full Mueller report?
I think it's hard to say exactly how it turns out in the end. I view this Chairman Nadler, you know, saying that he's going to be authorized to issue the subpoenas as a way to be putting pressure on Attorney General Barr to really release as much as possible of the Mueller report. There will be quite a back and forth between the legislative and executive branches over this particular issue. And it may be the case that in the end they can come to a fair accommodation of one another's interests.
With the House showing its willingness to use its power to take on the Trump administration, how do you think we should expect these political battles to play out? I mean, they just seem like we're not going to get to a place where there might be some compromise.
With the Mueller report, I mean, it's so high profile, and you know, it's not clear to me that it's necessarily in the president's political interest to be seen as holding something back. And this may be why the president has said he does not intend to use executive privilege in the context of the Mueller report. For example, in another instance with Congressman Cummings' investigation regarding security clearances, we've seen over the past 2 years, actually, that the White House has been very reluctant and resistant to essentially turn over any information regarding those issues. And what we see out of the White House on that particular investigation is really kind of a stonewalling. And so that is one I'm watching very closely, because it seems to me that Congress would have a pretty valid interest in making sure that classified information is treated in an appropriate way within the White House, and that security clearances are granted and denied in an appropriate way.
Would the president be able to claim executive privilege in that instance about security clearances, given that it's already been reported that I think 24 folks were granted security clearance and there's already been a White House whistleblower in this? Like, is it too far for the president to, or the White House, to claim executive privilege here?
The president and the White House can go ahead and claim executive privilege with respect to something in response to a subpoena. The question is what happens after that, because that begins a discussion about whether the claim is a valid claim of executive privilege. And that will be a discussion that happens between the two branches. And potentially, if the Congress isn't satisfied with what it is getting, it can become a court battle.
Margaret Taylor is a senior editor at Lawfare, and she's a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's Dan Zinovega with The Takeaway.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.